You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of this month's cover story, The Passion of Dwayne Johnson, by Chris Heath, with photographs by Mark Seliger, styled by Ilaria Urbanati. Johnson says that he and Diesel are philosophically two different people, and we approach the business of movie making in two very different ways. The faults he sees in Diesel seem pretty clear from this description he offers of his own contrasting philosophy. It's the philosophy of going into work every day, looking at everybody as equal partners, and looking at the studio as equal partners, and looking at the crew, regardless of where you're at, either on the call sheet or otherwise, as equal partners, with respect and with humility, and being respectful of the process and every other human being who is putting in just as much time, just as much hard work and sweat equity, if not more. And I think it's always been important to me to always be straight up and look somebody in the eye. And if you say you're going to do something, do it. Over time, Diesel has voiced his own oblique observations about this situation. He has put down their differences to them being two alpha males. Johnson, sounds like him to say that, sure, characterized Johnson, perhaps slightly patronizingly, as Hollywood's second multicultural megastar, whom he's proud to see following in his footsteps. Johnson, he talks like that, and said that, "I protected Dwayne more than he'll ever know, but he appreciates it. He knows he only has one big brother in the film world, and that's me." Johnson, "I have one big brother, and it's my half-brother, and that's it." Then, this summer, in an interview in Men's Health, Diesel returned to the subject, casting any conflict as the benign side effect of purposeful method manipulation on his part. "My approach at the time was a lot of tough love to assist in getting that performance where it needed to be. As a producer to say, okay, we're going to take Dwayne Johnson, who's associated with wrestling, and we're going to force this cinematic world, audience members, to regard his character as someone that they don't know. Hobbs hits you like a ton of bricks. That's something that I'm proud of, that aesthetic. That took a lot of work. We had to get there. And sometimes, at that time, I could give a lot of tough love. Not Fellini-esque, but I would do anything I'd have to do in order to get performances in anything I'm producing." Reminded of this quote, Johnson at first simply bellows with laughter. "You know, I'll tell you this," he says eventually. "One part of me feels like there's no way I would dignify any of that bullshit with an answer. But here's the truth. I've been around the block a lot of times. Unlike him, I did not come from the world of theater. And, you know, I came up differently and was raised differently. And I came from a completely different culture and environment. And I go into every project giving it my all. And if I feel that there's some things that need to be squared away and handled and taken care of, then I do it. And it's just that simple. So when I read that, just like everybody else, I laughed. I laughed hard. We all laughed. And somewhere I'm sure Fellini is laughing, too." Other collaborators think of Johnson far more fondly. Ryan Reynolds, who co-stars in this month's Red Notice, has known him for 20 years. By odd coincidence, He hitched a ride on the same plane with us back from Cancun in 2002. The thing that sets him apart, Reynolds says, is obviously he's kind of superhuman in stature and looks and charisma and all those things, but he has an innate ability to always laugh at himself. And that, in and of itself, is a superpower, you know? I mean, that opens the door, you know, spiritually, emotionally, and literally. I think that's always been in his arsenal, and that's always been the thing that I think really allows people in. He offers a further observation. I think sort of the allure of DJ is that, to a certain extent, he wears his heart on his sleeve. And there is, underneath the muscles, which are all, by the way, spray-on muscles, I found out when we were shooting, he is incredibly vulnerable. Emily Blunt, who starred with Johnson in Jungle Cruise, echoes the sentiment. I know the first thing everyone notices is that colossal framework of a human. But what people who really know him well know is that, held inside, it is this equally oceanic compassion and humility, she says. He's got this sort of blazing charisma that he's really known for, but he's quite shy and introverted. He's an interesting and very rare mix of really confident and really humble. Blunt adds, he also happens to be a tequila-swilling, fun-as-hell hang, and he's got the filthiest laugh in the world. You get some sense of Blunt and Johnson's comic antagonist buddy's rapport in Jungle Cruise, but a more untethered version can be seen in some of the interviews they did together to promote the film. He has no boundaries whatsoever, Blunt tells me. He's a very confusing person, because he's the most polite gentleman in the world, and then he will just push the boundaries until he is saying things that will just make your head spin to make you laugh. I think that he's got this rebellious kid in him that won't be straitjacketed. In one interview, asked what they would take into the jungle, Johnson suggested Vagisil for Blunt, who, not to be outdone, countered with anal beads for her co-star. This is not how Disney family films are generally plugged, and Johnson concedes that this particular conversation provoked concern. I can't tell you, he says, how quick we got those calls. We really love your chemistry and what you guys are doing, but can we dial it back a little bit on the anal beads? Not that he was particularly of a mind to listen. If your true imperative is to be yourself, you have to let that water flow where it needs to flow. I don't like to feel like I have constraints on, or I'm trying to fit a mold, or this is how it's done, so this is how you should do it, he says. I do have a little bit of a challenge with that. Maybe a lot of a challenge. And so when they say dial it back, I say, sure, watch this. Red Notice with Reynolds and Gal Gadot appears on Netflix this month. Ross and Thurber, who wrote and directed it, calls it an old-school, globe-trotting, swashbuckler action-adventure comedy writ large. Big action, big laughs, big stars, big twist, which is actually a pretty fair description. It is also, says Johnson, the biggest movie Netflix has invested in. Production was suspended for lockdown, during which first Lauren, then both young girls, and then Johnson caught COVID. Johnson kept posting on Instagram as though nothing was happening. He didn't want people to know, not while he was still working, out how bad this might be. It was a daunting time, he says, because you never know how sideways this can go. In the end, none of them suffered too much. Lauren's symptoms were the worst. Johnson just had some fatigue and body aches, no fever, but he did lose his sense of taste and smell for a month. The night before Johnson was due back on set, there was a storm, and he awoke to find that the power was out at his home in Georgia. Trying to leave the property, clock ticking on a massive production, Johnson was perturbed to discover that the weighty metal gates blocking his driveway wouldn't open. The manual override didn't work either. Most of us at this juncture would have bowed to a circumstance beyond our control. Is it a surprise to discover that that is not the Dwayne Johnson way? Johnson started to push at the gate, and push harder and harder, until this is a man, bear in mind, who can bench press well over 400 pounds. He ripped the gate's hinges loose from the wall. He did so abruptly enough, in fact, that the gate gashed his forehead before he could throw it down. As is also his way, Johnson posted about what he had done on Instagram. Not my finest hour, but a man's gotta go to work. Showing the gate discarded on the verge outside his driveway. He didn't show a picture of himself because he didn't want people to see his wound. The next day, he also posted footage of the three repairmen as they carried one of these gates between them with some evident difficulty. Many of the subsequent comments praised the superhero-esque nature of Johnson's feat, though these were somewhat eclipsed by a laconic note from Reynolds. The gate opened the other way. Well, retorts Johnson now, as though offering necessary context, he's an asshole. I remind Reynolds of this day's events. Oh, yes, of course, his gate, he says. I guess he ripped it off its hinges because Dwayne has rabies. In recent years, Johnson's movie career has been only one aspect of what he does. Aside from various TV projects, his many other pursuits include his Project Rock Collection sportswear brand with Under Armour, his own sports drink, ZOA, co-owning the XFL Football League, as well as the aforementioned tequila Terramana. Johnson summarizes it like this. I consider myself an industrialist and an entrepreneur and a businessman as well, and I'm in the relationship business. I'm in the customer service business. I'm in the consumer product business, and I'm certainly in the movie business. Johnson's excitement when he talks about these other parts of his life seems entirely unforced. I love building, he says, and I love creating products and brands that have a certain quality to them to deliver to people. But I think the stripped-away answer here is, I love it. I love what I do. Honestly, I love building from scratch with these two old dinosaur hands. Winfrey, who knows a little bit about this kind of success, tells me, the reason I feel a connection to The Rock, to Dwayne, is because I see so much of myself in him. Not in the physicality, not in the disciplined workout, not in that, but I see this kind of hunger that he has for life and for bettering himself. And the truth is, it doesn't matter how many followers he has, or how popular, or how much money. I always say my heart is in my brand. His heart and his mana is his brand, right? You can sit with your team and you can plan what the next level of growth in your company is going to be and what you want to do, but you cannot buy the people's trust. What he's sharing with you, no matter what that is, you believe it. Whether you drink tequila or not, you believe that he believes that's great tequila. Now you want some of that tequila. And that's his brand. His brand is his truth. And the trust that we have in that truth. Just the energy and the drive that this guy has, observes his friend Dana White, president of the Ultimate Fighting Championship. I mean, eventually, most people get to a point where, all right, I've pretty much done it all. I've achieved everything. I have a ton of money. Not this guy. The drive is unbelievable. That's who he is. This guy loves to win. And I think he was raised with some hardcore work ethic. Johnson stresses the latter. I think these days there could be a tendency for people to think that things come easy, he says. It does not. No, it's actually quite the opposite. You know, I stay up at night putting in the work. but also really deeply contemplating the next move and the multiple moves and the impact and effect that this one thing will have. He also, sooner or later, always relates his drive ever forward back to those formative experiences in his youth. "If you've ever been hungry," he says, "then you'll never be full." When I point out to Johnson that nonetheless he must be aware that the wolf is some distance from the door now, he jumps on this notion with a certain glee. "It's so funny you bring that up. I say that all the time, that the wolf is always scratching. In my mind, I'm always a few days away from getting evicted." I ask Johnson whether he'd like to be a billionaire. "Hell yeah," he says. "Sure." And I continue, does he think he's going to be? It says plenty that Johnson receives this question not as one about speculative pie-in-the-sky ambition, but as one requesting practical information. "I don't like to think like that, in those terms," he says, "but I hear you, and I'll just say that I'm aware what these valuations of these businesses that are growing are, and what the street value is, and what the trajectory is. I'll just say that. For example, we'll take Terramana. George Clooney, as you know, he sold his tequila for $1 billion. At that time, when he sold it, they were selling approximately 150,000 to 175,000 cases a year. We are approximately 600,000 cases right now, as you and I speak. So that will give you an idea of what the valuation of the company is and the brand. So there's my answer." Still, there are some moments in all lives for which no amount of success can offer sufficient insulation. On January 15th, 2020, the first morning of the Red Notice production, Johnson was just pulling off the freeway exit in Atlanta when his phone rang. It was his family assistant. "I have some news," she said. "Your father just passed away." Johnson said he'd call back. He pulled into the production base camp and sat there in his truck. Around him, people were waving and happy, fired up with day one enthusiasm. "I was just numb," he tells me. "I sat in my truck for about 10 minutes, and I didn't know. I was trying to figure out what my next move was. Do I call my mom? Do I call my wife? Do I call my dad's wife?" Eventually, he phoned his wife, asking her not to tell his mother until he could be there. After, he sat there some more. Should he head home right now? He couldn't decide. Then he heard his father's voice in his head. Wrestling was a tough world, not without its early deaths, and Johnson remembered what his father would always say in their wake: the show must go on. That was his father's way, and that was the guidance his son would take that day. Johnson left his truck and went to work. It was a day of camera and costume test. He didn't tell anyone. "Nobody needs to know that," he says. "Work all that out on my own." The following week, Johnson delivered an emotional eulogy at his father's funeral. "Man, I wish I had one more shot," he began, "you know, just to say goodbye, say I love you, say I thank you, I respect you." When we first meet in Los Angeles, he echoes the same thought to me, talking about when you don't get a chance to say goodbye, there's just so much like inventory check that you do. A few days later, during one of our last conversations, we wander back to the same subject. "I wish I had another shot to say goodbye to my old man," he says, "because..." Johnson pauses. "We have been sharing increasingly intense personal discussions. I lost my own father suddenly, not long before these interviews, and Johnson now decides to tell me a fuller, more painful version of those last weeks. Toward the end of 2019, his father had published a memoir, Soul Man, The Rocky Johnson Story. Johnson was well aware that his father had been planning a book. "I was all for it," he says, "and I was an advocate for it. I just had to ask him months in advance, My only ask is that you be real and open and honest and forthright with what you want to say, and be careful about what you say. Johnson received a copy of Soul Man only after it was published and his father was out doing book signings. What he read, he found extremely disappointing and distressing. Repeatedly, in Johnson's eyes, the book's stories aggrandized his father at the expense of the truth, and often at the expense of others who were no longer around to correct the record, and also at the expense of Johnson himself. So much of it, he says, was not true. One section hit particularly hard because it related to the moment in Johnson's life, the eviction from their Hawaii apartment when he was 14, that for him is a foundational moment, a key event in their shared family history, and one he has constantly referred back to over the course of his life. In the book, says Johnson, he tells the reader, "This absolutely never happened. We were never evicted out of Hawaii." And when I ask my son about it, he told me, "Oh yeah, Dad, I just tell that to make people feel good. I just tell that for people to make them feel good. If they're going through hard times themselves, they'll look at this and somehow become maybe a little inspired that they can get through their hard times too." An even more naked affront was loudly trailed on the book's cover, forward by Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson. In this, Johnson purportedly shared detailed tales of how his father's career had foreshadowed his own, explaining that my dad was far more successful than I was and for a much longer period of time. Problem was, he had never written or said these words. I was like, "Am I effing crazy?" he tells me. "Did I write this? When did this happen?" Again, I was so upset. One sentence in particular stuck in his throat. "Rocky Johnson is responsible for everything I've done in wrestling, the movies, TV shows, and overall business opportunities." And so, over Christmas, Johnson called his father to have it out. "We got into a massive fight," Johnson remembers. He says his father's principal defense was one of denial, blaming his ghostwriter and apologizing only for not proofreading the book. The thing about the Hawaii eviction, for instance, he had never said that. The fake introduction, he had no idea it was there. Later, I find a wrestling podcast in which the book's ghostwriter, Scott Teal, openly discusses having written this Dwayne Johnson foreword, though he states that he did so at Rocky's instruction and with Rocky's guidance. The conversation between Johnson and his father was a rough one. "It was the biggest fight we've ever had, and we had gotten into some doozies in the past," he says. "I had leaned into my dad like I never had before because I was just really disappointed and hurt." And that was where things were left between them. Normally, Johnson says, he prefers not to let things fester. "I like to take care of things with expediency, and if there's some shit we need to take care of, let's take care of it. Let's dive into it. Even if it's hard, it's okay." But that was a different thing. It's just a different, unique relationship that you have with your old man. That phone call would be the last time they spoke. "We had some good times," says Johnson. "We had some rough times. We had some fighting times. And my dad always knew that there were parts of his life that were effed up. And in the end, away from the noise, we had some pretty raw conversations about who he was and who he always wanted me to be. And the good stuff is what will always be in the forefront of my mind, because I recognize that in our complicated testosterone-driven relationship, some of the best parts of me that I've been fortunate to share with the world, I get from him. The resilience, the work ethic, the no one's going to give it to you, so you got to get your ass out there and work it. Earn respect, type of credo I get from him, and I will always carry that with me. As Johnson tells me this, his voice often breaks. Several times he pauses. Hold on one second, he says. It'll pass. We both wait. And then Dwayne Johnson gathers himself and carries ever onward. All that Zaz. In his 15 years running Discovery, David Zaslav was a media mogul for Main Street. Now, with the creation of Warner Brothers Discovery, he's poised to become America's king of content and is gearing up for a battle with Disney and Netflix by Joe Pompeo, with opening photograph by Mark Seliger. View from the top, David Zaslav in July, looking out over Manhattan. David Zaslav's face lit up as the SUV approached the lot. It was around 8 a.m. on Tuesday, June 1st, 70-something degrees and sunny in Burbank, California, where Zaslav was arriving for his first ever visit to one of the world's most storied entertainment studios. After Zaslav flashed his negative COVID results for the security guards, the car rolled onto the 110-acre property in Ersatz Metropolis in the shadow of the Santa Monica Mountains. Zaslav gazed out the window and looked up at the iconic Warner Brothers water tower, looming over him like some ancient shrine. If reality hadn't already sunk in, it was sinking in now. "Can you believe this?" he gushed. "It's really happening." 2 weeks earlier, Zaslav, the president and CEO of Discovery since 2007, had pulled off the slickest coup in the current era of mega mergers, a $43 billion deal hashed out in spy-like secrecy over 3 months from February to May. The transaction, now inching through the regulatory gauntlet and expected to close around mid-2022, will relieve AT&T of its debt-ridden Warner Media portfolio, which the telecom giant had acquired just 3 years earlier at nearly double the price. Discovery, in turn, will amass a powerful new arsenal in the streaming wars, uniting the likes of OWN, Animal Planet, The Food Network, and HGTV with the more formidable armies of HBO, CNN, the former Turner Broadcasting Networks, and the Warner Brothers Library. Once the deal closes, the combined company's revenues will be second only to Disney, and Zaslav, a wildly successful but still relatively second-tier media executive, will find himself at a table with the reigning kings of content. As a New York Times headline declared after the deal was announced on May 17th, a titan ascends in media world's Game of Thrones. Zaslav had flown into Burbank to introduce himself to Warner Media's 27,000 employees. The vast majority of them would be tuning in via video conference, but 100 of Warner's top executives were there in the flesh, their first time back since the start of the pandemic. Zaslav had brought along Discovery's chief corporate operating officer, David Levy, and the company's HR boss, Adria Alpert-Rom. Their driver deposited them at George Clooney's former bungalow so Zaslav could prepare. The previous evening, during the plane ride, Zaslav had reflected on his history. Just like the real-life Warner Brothers, he was a descendant of Polish Jews whose grandparents fled Europe in the years before the Holocaust, when the Warners were urgently lobbying U.S. lawmakers to stop Hitler's rise to power. In another deeply personal connection, one of Zaslav's heroes is Steve Ross, the legendary former CEO of Warner Communications and Time Warner. In 2012, Zaslav received an award in Ross's name from the UJA Federation of New York. Now, he was taking over Ross's former company, about to give a presentation in the Stephen J. Ross Theater. He walked on stage with Jason Kyler, the current CEO of Warner Media, who had been kept in the dark about the merger until right before the news broke. Zaslav isn't the type of guy who takes notes, but today he was clutching a manila folder full of them. He wanted to get this right. There had been a similar town hall in June 2018 when John Stankey, the veteran of AT&T executive who'd originally been appointed to run Warner Media, appeared alongside Richard Plepler, the long-running leader of HBO. It didn't go over well. Stankey sent a collective cringe through Warner Media's creative community, rattling off jargon like hours of engagement and monetized through alternate models of advertising. A video of the conversation was leaked to the Times, and 8 months later, Plepler left the company. Stanky is now AT&T's CEO. Zaslav made a much better first impression. He talked about his origins and his family. He talked about talent and storytelling. He talked about heritage and creativity. Sometimes, new bosses come in acting like they know everything. Zaslav's message was the opposite. "We are not coming in here thinking that we know the answers," he said. "There is a ton we don't know." In the words of a rank-and-file employee who was watching from home, he nailed it. Toward the end of the presentation, Zaslav revealed the new company's name, Warner Brothers Discovery, and its slogan, "The stuff that dreams are made of." "It's from the Maltese Falcon, which is a Warner Brothers movie," he said. "It's one of my favorite movies, and that line comes at the very end of the movie when a police officer comes and the Maltese Falcon is sitting there and the police officer asks Humphrey Bogart, 'What is that?' And he says, 'It's the stuff that dreams are made of.' And to me, this journey that we are all on together to tell the best stories, to have our content seen everywhere in the world, the excitement of it, to get the best storytellers to be in business with us, and to be delighted and excited about telling their stories and sharing them, that is a dream." After the town hall, an outdoor reception, and meetings with various executives, Zaslav hopped aboard an open-air van for a tour of the lot. When the van slowed to a halt in front of the fountain from Friends, Zaslav jumped off for a picture and texted it to his wife and kids. Inside the Warner Brothers Museum, he strolled through Batman's Batcave and Harry Potter's Wizarding World before stopping to pose with Wonder Woman's lasso. Then he hit the gift shop and bought a bunch of hats, coffee mugs, and tote bags. Zaslav's swag stash is the stuff of legend. Later, aboard a private jet back to New York, Zaslav and his lieutenants reclined in their seats and scoured the news coverage while an attendant poured some Chardonnay. Zaslav was still pinching himself. "How lucky are we that we get to do this, that this is our job," he said. "I really do believe this is going to be the best media company in the world." They raised their glasses and took a drink. A month and a half later, Zaslav was zipping around Central Park in his signature sporty workwear, white golf, TV short sleeve shirt, Eurosport cap, matching gray vest, and khakis. The ensemble was completed by a pair of tortoiseshell Ray-Bans, framing Zaslav's square-jawed face. He usually walks the park at 5 a.m., but today he'd pushed it back to 7 for my benefit. When Zaslav is in Manhattan, he shacks up in the Central Park West duplex that he bought from Conan O'Brien for $25 million in 2010. During the pandemic's pre-vaccination phase, he laid low in his oceanfront East Hampton estate. But now, he splits his time between the Hamptons, the city, and increasingly Beverly Hills, where Zaslav and his wife Pam are renovating the historic Woodland Mansion, once owned by the Godfather producer Robert Evans. The night of our meetup, he was hosting a party at Ralph Lauren's Polo Bar to celebrate the launch of Chip and Joanna Gaines' Magnolia Network on Disney+, the company's budding streaming service. But the day was young, and Zaslav likes to be on the move, so we walked, emphasis on walked as opposed to, say, strolled, in the rapidly rising heat, for more than an hour before settling into an outdoor table at Barney Greengrass, the 113-year-old Upper West Side deli and go-to smoked fish joint for New York's media elite. Other high-profile regulars include Zaslav's good friends David Geffen and Alan Grubman. Zaslav ordered a plate of scrambled eggs with lox and introduced me to the establishment's third-generation proprietor, Gary Greengrass. "My grandfather in Brooklyn," Zaslav said in his New York accent. "Grandfather, used to, on special occasions, come in and then come back with the whitefish and the Nova from his grandpa. The interesting thing about this store is most of America is disappearing. It's disappearing because you have Walmart and you have Amazon and you have these big stores. He has specialty items that are so niche. Lox, sturgeon, Nova, cream knishes, matzo ball, soup. He hasn't been tipped over. A waiter brought us the aforementioned lox, and Zaslav completed his thought. We need Main Street in America. Zaslav is, in many ways, the mogul of Main Street America. That's largely a virtue of the servicey middlebrow reality programming that his networks have turned into a cultural phenomenon, whether it's cake competitions, Food Network, pimple popping, TLC, paranormal adventures, Travel Channel, home renovation porn, HGTV. Or, as I was binge-watching in my hotel room the night before our hangout, Shark Week, Discovery Channel. Zaslav's humble background reflects that same sensibility. Never mind that he made $37.7 million last year and pals around with more famous people than can fit in a Rolodex. Now 61, Zaslav was born in Brooklyn to the children of dirt-poor immigrants, one of whom sold plumbing supplies out of a wheelbarrow on the Brooklyn Bridge. He came of age in middle-class Rockland County, New York, where Zaslav and his future wife worked as lifeguards together at a local summer camp. They didn't start dating until 7 years later, following a chance encounter on the streets of Manhattan. After a year at Cornell in the university's tennis program, Zaslav ditched the Ivy League for state school at SUNY Binghamton. He roomed with his closest childhood friend, Perry Kritchmar. While I was chatting with Kritchmar for this story, he happened to get a call from Dave. "When you see Dave and Pam," Kritchmar told me, "they're the same two people they were." Zaslav remains close with other buddies from back home, and he flies a bunch of them to Vegas every year for a poker getaway. One such trip included tickets to see the Eagles. He's a family man, a doting grandpa of two, and a loving father to three ambitious millennials. One works at CNN, one at Axios, and another is pursuing a master's in education. "He talks to his kids all the time," said media investor Ken Lehrer, who himself talks to Zaslav almost every day. Zaslav's 89-year-old mother lives in a suburban North Jersey retirement community right up the road from me. He goes out there to visit her. He raved about my local diner and bagel shop. "When I think of him," says Nancy Pelosi, who first met Zaslav on one of his visits to Washington after taking charge of Discovery, "I think of his audience. He's a reflection of his audience. He's a regular guy. He has no grandeur about him. He connects with that. He identifies with that. And that's why he's successful with what he does." Or, as Steven Spielberg says, "He wears Patagonia vest. He's not concerned with stature." As a media executive, Zaslav has always been lower profile than his more swaggering peers, the Bob Igers and Rupert Murdochs and Richard Pleplers of the world, or even someone like CNN chief Jeff Zucker, who is also tight with Zaslav. After initially announcing that he would step down later this year, Zucker will now reportedly stay at Warner Media, at least until the deal closes. Neither executive will say anything about Zucker's plans. Part of it has to do with Zaslav's personality. Part of it has to do with the reality that Discovery, with all due respect, is simply less consequential, even when you throw in all of its global investments, like Eurosport, which owns the Olympics rights in Europe. But Warner Brothers Discovery has catapulted Zaslav to the upper reaches of the stratosphere. As his Hamptons buddy Joy Behar told me, "It's like Obama or Biden said after the ACA passed, this is a big effing deal." Well, this is a big effing deal for David Zaslav and for the industry. His new rock star clout was apparent when dozens of moguls emerged from quarantine in July and returned to the mountains of Sun Valley, Idaho, for the annual Allen and Company retreat. "There was a line wherever he was," said Oprah Winfrey, who didn't go this year, but got a scene report from Gail King. Another big shot who was there confirmed it was certainly a new level of activity. Michael Nathanson, a Wall Street analyst who was covering the merger, put it like this: "With this deal, his leadership has a much broader impact on society. He's like a Bob Iger. The assets he will manage will have so much more of an impact on society and the public conversation than anything he's done to this point." Another prominent analyst, Rich Greenfield of Lightshed Partners, told me Discovery, at the end of the day, was never going to be a major player given its size and scale. And now, you move from Food Network to Game of Thrones and the DC Comics library. This is a massively different job and far more complex. But now, Warner Brothers Discovery actually has a shot at competing globally at scale. In the ever-expanding streaming world, where competitors live and die by their IP, the masters of the universe are Netflix and the Disney bundle, which includes Hulu. Everything else is generally seen as being in a lesser league, although HBO Max, at least in terms of library, arguably has an edge on the other major players: Amazon Prime, Apple TV Plus, Peacock, CBS All Access, Showtime, Paramount Plus, and of course Discovery Plus. Where will Warner Brothers Discovery rank once the ink dries? I believe that this collection of brands and global content puts us in that top tier, Zaslav told me. My job is to make sure that we get there and we stay there. And you know, that we have all the tools. We have the full menu to reach 200 million homes. The mashup is not without skepticism. Analysts have pointed to the challenge of integrating Discovery's apples with Warner Media's oranges, a process that can't even begin until regulators finally approve the deal and the transaction closes. Discovery's stock has been downgraded as analysts wait to learn more about Zaslav's plans for the combined company. In the meantime, the streaming wars will only become more cutthroat. Time is the enemy, Zaslav said. Mergers like this are always rolled out with bullish gusto. Sometimes, despite the best intentions, they turn out to be disasters. "The stuff that dreams are made of" is a quote from the Maltese Falcon about how the thing that seemed like a priceless treasure was actually worthless garbage that brought chaos and despair to everyone around it. HBO's John Oliver, who's known to bite the hand that feeds him, joked in a June 6th segment. Anyway, good luck with the merger. I'm sure everything's going to go great. I read Zaslav a critical assessment from Richard Rushfield's popular Hollywood newsletter, The Ankler. Lots of grand pronouncements about the great brands, the commitment to storytelling, with very little hint of how they fit together or why. So, they've got a random cluster of things and brands of wildly varying levels of quality, appealing to wildly different audiences. Where is the money going to come from to finance this massive storytelling expansion they are talking about? It's the same companies you had, now saddled with the cost and debt from the acquisitions. Zaslav, as you might expect, sees it differently. "I see the most wonderful buffet, the broadest, most compelling offering of global content in the world, all in one place," he said. "We need to catch Disney and Netflix, but the core advantage to this company is that we have a strategic plan in 2023 where we're driving to $8 billion in free cash flow. And so the mission of this company is going to be to spend more money on content. And the reason this deal makes sense is that we have the resources to invest in content. And we have the resources that most of our competitors don't have because they're investing in cable or broadband, or they're in the retail business, or they're in the cloud business. This is all we do, and this is who we are. With the marriage of Discovery and Warner Media, Zaslav's career has come full circle. He started as a corporate lawyer in the mid-1980s, working for LeBerf, Lamb, Green, and McRae, a now-defunct firm that specialized in public utilities. When the firm brought in an attorney named Richard M. Berman to establish a communications practice, Zaslav threw up his hand. These days, Berman is a federal judge who was assigned to the Jeffrey Epstein case. Back then, it just so happened that two of Berman's main clients were the Discovery Channel and Warner Cable. He also repped MTV. The nascent cable business was like the Wild West, and Zaslav's part in the rodeo was to write up licensing agreements, programming agreements, and deals to buy cable systems. He was really enthusiastic about that work, Berman recalls. The nature of TV was dramatically changing before your eyes. In 1988, as NBC was beginning to muscle into the cable arena, Zaslav wrote a letter to then-CEO Bob Wright, which Zaslav described in a 2004 interview. I said, I've spent the last 3 years working with MTV and Discovery. I spent a fair amount of time with Discovery chairman John Hendricks, going around the country trying to raise money and grow Discovery Channel. If you're serious about getting into the cable business, I'd love to sit down and talk to you. Wright gave Zaslav a call and was impressed enough to offer him a job. He said, I know a lot about the cable business, but I want to be in it in a leadership role, Wright recalled. He's brash, and he backed it up in his conversation. The two biggest partners at Zaslav's firm tried to talk him out of it. You're making a huge mistake, they warned, arguing that this whole cable thing wasn't going anywhere. Torn, Zaslav sought advice from Berman, who told him to go with his gut. I think he was destined, Berman says. At the Peacock, Zaslav was a key figure in the creation of CNBC and a part of the team that launched MSNBC. He led strategic development for all of the company's cable businesses, including USA Network, Bravo, Telemundo, and Sci-Fi, as well as overseeing outside investments in the History Channel, A&E, National Geographic, Sundance, and TiVo. Remember TiVo? Zaslav took Discovery public and embarked on a hit-making expansion of its highly addictive reality programming, capitalizing on the popularity of such marathon-ready classics as Deadliest Catch, Man vs. Wild, and Meerkat Manor. Under Zaslav, Discovery brought us The Cake Boss and Honey Boo Boo, Impossible Planet, and Serengeti, the Oprah Winfrey Network, and Investigation Discovery, which created a show in partnership with Vanity Fair, whose owner, Advance, is one of Discovery's largest shareholders. In 2018, in Zaslav's last major move before the Warner deal, Discovery closed on its $14.6 billion acquisition of Scripps Networks Interactive, which is how Zaslav came to be the steward of HGTV, Food Network, Travel Channel, DIY Network, and a smattering of other properties. One of them is a news channel called TVN that is essentially the CNN of Poland. Who knew? Like CNN, during the Trump era, TVN became a target of Poland's far-right government. The country's prime minister, Mateusz Morawiecki, referred to Zaslav as the head of opposition on a Zoom call between the two men. I'm not getting thrown out of Poland again if I can stop it, Zaslav told me. Zaslav and I were on a Zoom call of our own one morning in mid-July. He was in California that week, camped out at the Beverly Hills Hotel. He popped on screen a little after 6:30 a.m. Pacific time. Zaslav was wearing a crisp white dress shirt, his short silver hair parted to the right. He picked up his laptop and gave me a tour of the swanky bungalow that serves as his West Coast domicile until the Woodland property is completed. It has a private pool and a giant portrait of Elizabeth Taylor, who spent 6 of her 8 honeymoons at the hotel. It's a great meeting place, he said. Zaslav, also known as Zaz or Zass, otherwise known as DZ, lives for meetings. He loves gabbing, kibitzing, schmoozing, and peppering his companions with questions. Even during the depths of quarantine, he was as much of a social creature as lockdown would allow. He worked the phones nonstop. He took physically distanced walks along the beach. He had virtual hangouts and poker games with the likes of Jimmy Buffett, John McEnroe, Tom Freston, Cheryl Hines, Suzanne Todd, and Shelley and Irving Azoff, among others. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Parts A and B are also available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.